Hello and welcome to What the Hack, the show that is dedicated to taking all aspects of cybersecurity and breaking them down into easy to understand bites. My name is Sean, a cybersecurity professional working in the Aberdeen, Scotland area. This week we welcome Stephen Chappendama from Founder Vine. Stephen's a cybersecurity professional currently working for Raytheon UK as a senior software engineer within cyber and intelligence, an alumni of the University of Hertfordshire with a Bachelor of Science of Computer Science and Networks. Stephen has previously worked for the infrastructure development team at the University of Hertfordshire, focusing on CIAM and cybersecurity. Passionate about diversity in tech, Stephen has been working with Founder Vine as technology manager, helping tomorrow's founders shape the future. Founder Vine works with ambitious leaders and entrepreneurs to create, test, and sustain entrepreneurial ventures across the UK. We hope you enjoy. Hello, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. This is going to be a little bit of a different type of episode for the listeners because we're not discussing one individual area of cybersecurity, but rather how can the user improve themselves on pretty much all across the board. So, we'll sort of dive straight into the kind of discussion that we're going to be going for. There's various different areas of cybersecurity. We're going to consider yourself an expert in the field, but an expert with a little bit of a difference, if you like, an expert with the view that people can do more themselves. They don't actually have to hire people like yourself to do it, which is a little bit backwards when you think about it that way, because you make a living off of this stuff, and now we're telling people not to do that. So
yeah, it's definitely an interesting viewpoint, but I think businesses need to focus more on empowering themselves. And yeah, looking forward to today's discussion.
Fantastic. Good to know. I like the viewpoint that you've got, though. I mean, it's quite refreshing to see professionals and experts with the kind of expertise that you've got to say to people, you don't need me for everything. You know, there's so many people out there that IT specifically has been one over the years that said, don't worry yourselves with that headache. We'll take care of it for you. You can just pay us to do it. But it's not that complicated anymore.
Yeah, because I think when we start even looking at the, I guess, cybersecurity job deficit that we have, if a lot more organizations were, I guess, doing it themselves, mm-hmm. we'd have more people entering the pipeline because more people will be picking up the skills because, yeah, practice does make perfect. Mm-hmm. So I think the do-it-yourself approach is definitely another route into cybersecurity for so many different people.
Yeah, I mean, let's clarify just at the moment, though, there are certain areas of this industry that people will, like businesses and even individuals to a certain degree, will need people like yourself to fix. We're not saying that everyone can do everything, but they certainly can do the basics.
Yeah, so I think when it comes to, let's say, malware analysis, to analyze the malware, yes, you're going to need specialist knowledge.
Yeah.
But when it's setting up the defenses, yeah, I think from that level, we can start training and helping, I guess, businesses become more self-aware and picking up some of these tasks themselves.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So the areas that people can focus on themselves, and this goes beyond businesses, actually. This goes down to the personal level. I mean, we always say that businesses are only as strong as their weakest link, which tends to be an employee that doesn't really care about it that much. And inevitably, that is who lets in the phishing attack or the malware attack or something like that. And then it all kind of dials back. So the areas that they can focus on to improve themselves straight off the bat, I mean, we've written down a few here. We've got things like password management and phishing and ransomware, social engineering, that kind of thing. With all of them comes a sort of common theme, really, and it is simply just to pay more attention to it.
Yeah, I think protection is another theme that comes from it. Mm-hmm. When people start realizing how valuable their data or asset or businesses, you want to protect it. So even if we take, for instance, when you buy a house and you see that the back door is broken,
yep,
one of your priorities is to fix it. So when people start taking that viewpoint about the business, so if you can get that buy-in from your employees, say, yeah, this is our asset, we must protect it. Yeah, you start seeing people more being more receptive to these cyber policies around password management, and yeah, protecting data.
Yeah, it's quite interesting you use the house analogy, actually. It's one that I've heard before, where it was a friend of mine that put it up on the screen and said, which house does the robber want to steal from? And then they put a padlock on the front door, just for illustration purposes, and says, well, you would go for the one that doesn't have that, you know. And then he started to put security cameras and a little guard out front and all this kind of stuff. You would go for the easier target. Now,
yeah, definitely.
Businesses aren't like that, though, are they?
But even if we use an example of, let's say, okay, we've gone for the easier target, but even if there's an option where there's a security guard at the front, I don't know if there was a meme that people used to spread around of a security guard at a football stadium patting down people, but not actually touching them. And it, from afar, then you know, if you, if you're carrying something, they're not actually going to do anything.
Sure.
So if people can see weak security, then they know.
Yeah, I think that's what they do. I mean, if you look at people that that we call it casing the place, they don't just dive in. They look around first to find out where the weak spots are, and then they attack it.
Yeah, definitely. So if your, I guess, employees or your defenses are visibly weak, even if they're there, you're inviting attention.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, it's sort of a bad stigma, really, but do you believe that there is a sort of weakness in an age level? So, for example, if you're a certain age, do you believe that's what criminals look at as a weaker target? Because, like, for example, the generation just like teenagers, early 20s, they've grown up with this kind of stuff, and they're almost experts in using the technology. They're not experts in protecting it, though. We've spotted that quite a lot. However, if you go to kind of 60 years old plus, this is all sort of new to them. You know, they've not grown up with it. They've not had time to embed it into themselves. So, do people look at that age group as the easier target?
I can see why someone would think that, but I think this is where having a diverse workforce, different age groups, comes into play. So right now there's a generation who love TikTok.
Yeah.
For me, I feel like that ship has sailed. I don't know anything about TikTok. So having a mixture of engineers on your team or security staff from age groups definitely helps. So when we even start thinking of 10 years ago, 2010, 2011, Stuxnet was the biggest worm ever made. But for some of the junior engineers, they might have still been in school and might not know about it. So they might not know why we implement no USB policy. So having that diverse range of people helps you see more threats. So it's not necessarily a weakness. It's just you have a wider range of, I guess, knowledge and understanding of the cyber landscape.
Yeah, I think you've definitely got a point there. I mean, it was a friend of the show, Jerry Grant, who had mentioned that people of all ages do get hacked in personal. It's just the older generation get hacked, but you hear about that more because it's larger sums of money that gets taken from them. You know, if a 20-year-old doesn't have £30,000 to lose, but he maybe has £400 or £500 to lose, but you don't hear about that so much because it's not as big figures. So they're not necessarily weaker.
Yeah, because even I've worked in a higher education institute before, and you would assume that obviously as we start going higher up in the degree count, people are getting smarter. But academics also get hacked. It doesn't matter how many degrees that they have, they still get caught out by phishing. It could be something as small as an email saying someone has contested your research. That will trigger them, and they will click on that link. So whether it's age, education level, anyone can get.
Yeah, I'm glad you've mentioned that, actually. Anyone can get hacked. No one is 100% safe. I suppose the best solution to make it 100% is to simply come offline. But then again, you're still susceptible to post phishing and things like that, and mobile smishing, it's called, and vishing, and all these hilarious terms that don't actually make sense. But I'm glad you've mentioned phishing, though, because that's, I believe, where we should begin with this. Because if I'm right, phishing is the most common threat that anyone faces on a sort of daily basis.
Yeah, definitely. I think if we look at how, I guess, tech has set ourselves up, mm-hmm. email, one of the main points of communication, be it at work,
yeah.
be it when you sign up for any service now, they will never just not ask for your email.
Yeah, they need somewhere to store your data, yeah.
I'm trying to even think, what else, what service can you sign up to? Maybe mobile only you can use, but at some point you're going to need an email address. Mm-hmm. So we're at a point where most people probably know their email, then who know their national ID number if they have one.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So an email is, we guarantee that everyone has one.
Yeah, I believe so. I believe so. I mean, I'm looking at the most IT illiterate people I know of, and they have email addresses, and they use it for, you know, online shopping and things like that. But you're right, that's the way that things have been built. Everyone has an email address, which makes it the biggest target.
Mm.
So in terms of phishing, then, you receive an email. What do you look for? How do you know it's legit?
We're at a point now where we kind of, or because I'm in cybersecurity, I control my own inbox. So if I don't like an email, I'll unsubscribe.
Yeah.
So if I receive an unsuspected email, if, for example, I buy my clothes at ASOS,
mm-hmm.
now a retailer who I've never bought before is sending me an offer, and all I have to do is click on that magical link, I become suspicious. I look at the email, see who is it from. Is it a reputable source? I look at the domain name,
mm-hmm.
and even just having a quick glance of the text, for some unknown reason, they just never get the language right.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I've been debating this one. You've hit on something that's brilliant, actually. There's grammatical errors. There's spelling mistakes, all that kind of stuff. There's been a huge, like a big debate that I've had with a number of different people on the show as well, actually. And two main sides to that that I would like your kind of view on, if possible. And there's one that thinks they're just being careless and they're getting out the phishing attacks as fast as possible, so they don't have time to proofread it. Great. That's a very legit and possibly correct answer. The other one is on the far end of this, is they're doing it on purpose, simply because they want you to miss it. Now, because if you miss it and click the link, you will miss the next thing that they put in front of you. You know, they'll ask you for your information. You won't think twice about it because you're not paying attention to it.
I'd never thought of it that way.
I don't know which one's right. That's the thing.
I'd like to think, yeah, that could be true. Mm. But then when you click the link, in a previous role, we've looked at phishing before, and we were using a service called GoFish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting service. So you can use it internally to teach and train staff members about phishing emails by sending
mm-hmm.
phishing emails yourself. So how it works is you give it a domain, so let's say google.com,
mm-hmm.
and you copy the website and create a dummy version of it.
Okay.
So for them to have spelling mistakes on their dummy version, that now seems intentional.
Yes, you'd think so.
So even if it's the grammatical errors, it now seems intentional. So yeah, you might actually be right, which is your second point.
Yeah, I mean, it may be that both ends are right, you know, who knows? But it's a very interesting concept. The GoFish site I've certainly used before. I've seen it live. For those listening, I would encourage them to go and check it out. So phishing's a big part of this, but it's not just email that it comes through. There's telephone. You get a phone call almost on a daily basis. I receive a phone call telling me, I think the latest ones are they're kind of automated voices telling me that I've committed tax fraud, and I will be arrested if I don't click one, if I don't push one on my telephone. That one's pretty interesting.
For me, it's always been the, have you been in a car crash?
Yes.
Yeah. That one has been a go-to favorite for years. But I think with the mobile phones, so I wrote a blog post just looking at our mobile phones, the importance of our phone number. So unlike email, if I subscribe your mobile number or it gets leaked somewhere, you would never know. So we have so many different services now where if your email address is leaked, even Chrome can tell you that, your email's been picked up in a paste bin somewhere on the internet. Whereas your mobile number, if it's in one of these databases, you will never know till they call you. So that's the sad part about, I guess, mobile. You can't really control it that much.
True.
And you have never called me to let me know that, oh yeah, your number's in a lot of databases for car accidents. And
I mean, it's sort of just reactive. I mean, you are right. I get the car accident phone call pretty often. More recently, again, it's become an automated voice to start with, and then they ask me if I have been. You know, it's like, oh, we've been in an accident. Is this right? And if you say yes, they say, hold on a second, and then put you through to someone. So I believe that the criminals are getting even lazier. They're really automating the process. But you are right in that respect, because the only thing that we can do at that point is then block that number, but then they will phone you from a different number, and then the process just starts again.
Even if they don't call you from that number, the data can get sold.
Yeah.
If it's a paste bin, which is usually from a leaked database, it's on the internet, and at some point someone else will find it.
Never.
I don't think we're at a point where we can change our mobile number as frequently as we can email or as easy.
I don't think so. I had this discussion with a friend actually who has literally got in their phone book, on their phone, they've got 8,000 contacts. Now, I don't know exactly why or how many duplicates there are or anything like that or where they even came from. But he said, I cannot change my phone number now simply because of that fact.
I think that's the one person I could definitely advocate to change their number.
Yeah, I would do the same.
New Year's must be a crazy day.
Yeah, I have no idea why he's got so many. You know, it's, I mean, I look at my own contact list on my phone and I've got less than 70, easy. So it's interesting, but we're gonna move on from phishing actually and into, I suppose a form of phishing, if you like, would be ransomware. It's a very severe form of a cyber threat, an attack, but it seems to me that it's one that's got a very easy solution to it if you do it quick enough, before it hits, actually, would be to simply back up the files. Is there anything else that we can do to ransomware?
Yeah, I think people forget the importance of backup. So even look at back when I was in university, we were always told when you do an assignment, make sure you saved it and you saved it somewhere else, whether it was on USB or on OneDrive. And it meant that whenever it came to assignment deadlines, you always had a working copy that even if anything was to happen, it was somewhere else you could go to. And for businesses, they need to, I guess, have that approach if something is to happen. Let's look at startups. They may have started and have such an accelerated growth that they haven't looked at a business disaster recovery plan. And when ransomware does hit, it's never something that you can predict to say, oh, tomorrow we might get hit by ransomware.
Yeah.
When it happens, it could be too late when you find out. But if you, you know, have an offsite backup, it could be on the cloud, it could be a different form, you'll be fine. And yeah, you won't, I guess, be held to ransom. Because I think with the strains of ransomware, when it first came out, it was, you know, a typical ransom. If you pay, you get your data back. But as it's evolved, sometimes people have paid and the data has been deleted or still leaked.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
The honor among thieves and all that.
Because they are criminals. You're not going to really, you know, expect them to hold the end of the deal.
that's true actually, because if you pay the ransom, they could just simply hold it and ask for more and just keep doing that. You can run up. I mean, we're talking about one of the biggest ransomware attacks, and was the NHS a few years back now. I believe I'm not 100% on this, so you can quote me. Maybe you've got some more knowledge on this. They paid some of it. Is that correct? Do you know that?
Oh, I'm not sure, actually, because the version of events that I've heard is because it was stopped, they took, I guess, some data was lost and they didn't pay.
Oh, interesting. I'm not 100% sure. I mean, I suppose the media will spin it as much as they want. I was told that certain areas of the NHS did pay the ransom to get the data back. I suppose my issue with personal data now is become such more of a common term, and so much personal data is out there that it almost losing its value. We're trying very hard to claim it all back and keep it private. But so much of it is out there. You don't even need an awful lot of information to find out everything about someone. You know, I mean, we did almost like a cloud word on, you know, what is personal data. And it just got silly, the amount of things that we put down. It was to the point where personal data is even the route you take to work, you know, the commute. That's personal data in effect.
But I think data is only valuable when married to something.
Yes, I agree with that.
So your route to work might not seem that valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
But when someone looks at your purchase history and sees you have a Rolex, it's now a different issue. You know, your route to work might have to change a bit because, someone might.
Absolutely. Yeah, the combination of little threads it could be devastating for you, you know.
And social media is definitely pushing that where people are oversharing.
Oh, completely. And they have been for years.
Yeah. And because of this oversharing and the data being available on the internet, it's unfortunately having an effect on the rise of from cybercrime to even home invasions.
Oh, it's horrendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean the one that gets me is I had a friend of a friend who checked themselves in at the airport on their way to Mauritius for a holiday. He said he's on his way for 2 weeks, which basically meant no one's in his house anymore. It's a horrible way of thinking, but it's absolutely legit.
Yeah. You know? I think it's one of those where you now have to look at your, I guess, your social lives, because some people do want to share.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about utilizing those settings that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all these companies are providing for us.
Mm-hmm.
So having private accounts, knowing who's on those accounts. So some people you'll find have a public profile and, you know, a friend and family one with maybe 15 people. And they will actually post that when they're on holiday on their personal one. And when they come back, then they say, oh, yeah, last week I was in Mauritius, you know, enjoying life.
Yeah, that's not a bad way of doing it, actually. I mean, if we look at social media, for example, and this is going to be a question that's going out to the audience as well, is the connection you've got on there. Do you know them all? I asked this question to a group of students that I gave a talk to once, and they're you know, it's a popularity contest to an age group like that. You know, I've got 4,000 connections and so on. I was like, yeah, you don't know who you're connected to, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, because I think we have this, I guess, influencer culture where, you know, mm-hmm. It's a career choice now. So people need to have X amount of followers. Even as you, I guess, start looking at the tech scene, there's now a tech influencer culture where, people want to grow their following so they can share more content, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still worth having that private account and not mixing the two. So your public persona profile, yes, you know, share what you must to do with work, etc., but not revealing your location, who you live with, how many people you live with, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the ones that's got that as a problem is Snapchat. They had a map filter function where you can see all the connections you've got on a map unless you turn it off.
Yeah. A
little scary, that one.
Yeah. But it also reminded me. So I remember a few years back, I was reading up on geolocation data.
Mm.
And if you go to quite a lot of the national parks in Africa, so in Kenya, for example, they didn't allow you to take pictures of rhinos.
Okay.
Because of the geolocation data that was withheld within the images, people could scrub that and actually know the location of a rhino.
Wow. So
people were using Snapchat, people who were using Instagram to take pictures and tagging. All someone has to do is go into that picture, upload it to Facebook, and they could look at the metadata and pull out the latitude and longitude, and that's where they know, the poachers know, where the rhinos are. So all of this oversharing, it does end up having like even stronger effects than people realize, held within the metadata of that photo.
That is absolutely terrifying. You know, it's a hell of a dark world to kind of work in, but live in as well. You know, for you to take a perfectly innocent photo of something that's really majestic and quite impressive, for someone to manipulate it like that is super impressive in a way, but it's terrifying.
But that saying, one man's trash is another man's gold.
Well, this is it. Yeah, this is absolutely true. So I like the idea of having a personal account and a sort of public account, if you like. I suppose it would be, you would walk a fine line of what you share in which account, you know. It's also how to protect the account. You know, you've mentioned like Facebook has got a lot of, I think Facebook is probably the most comprehensive in terms of its privacy settings. There's a lot in there that they won't tell you about, but you can actually change.
But, and yet, that's the key part. You said they won't tell you about.
Yeah.
And because it goes against a social network.
Oh, absolutely.
Social network should be social and open. But there's creeps out there. So, pulls up. And going against that grain.
Yeah, it's not what they want you to do. I know that, like, for example, Instagram's really only got... It's really only got the one setting, you know, is your account private or public? And if you click private, then no one can see what you're posting unless they've connected to you. I like the simplicity in it, but I'm not sure it's substantial enough to hold what you need.
So I know they have, protection for logins, two-factor authentication, but even... private stories, close friends. So I think one of the most infamous ones now is Colleen Rooney versus what's her name, Jamie Vardy's wife.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Colleen Rooney was noticing a lot of articles were being written about her based on information she was posting on a private Instagram account.
Okay.
And what she started doing was posting fake stories, but only to select groups of people, so she could narrow down where the stories was coming from. And eventually it led to a big reveal on Twitter. It was, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, they're currently in litigation over it because it was such a big thing. And that's another way. So people have private stories within their private accounts where you can say, you know what? Yes, this is a private account, but I only really want to share with my close friends.
Okay.
Hmm. And that's another way to go about it.
Oh, very, very interesting, actually. Very, very interesting. I want to quickly touch on something that you mentioned a minute ago, and that is two-factor authentication. It's something that I'm an advocate of. I really like the idea of it. There's so many accounts and things like that out there that you can enable it to. But the problem I keep coming up against with people, and it's sort of a... We sort of walk a line all the time of security over convenience. The problem that people tend to have, now this is a survey I've done of over 100 people, and staggering amount of them have said the same thing. It's too much hassle. You know, and I think we live in a culture now where everything is instant. You know, God forbid you have to hold an extra 6 seconds for you to get a code to type it in. It's a tricky one, really. What's your viewpoint on two-factor authentication? Is there a stronger method out there for it?
I think two-factor right now, in terms of ease of convenience for users, is the best method.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people always have their mobiles on them.
Yeah.
So it works. If we had to go back to the token-based, so I remember when NatWest first introduced, we had to have a separate card and a two-factor authenticator that you had to put that card in and then get a code.
I remember that.
Eventually, you lose that card. So then they said, oh, you can actually use your debit card. But then sometimes, I don't even know where my wallet is. It's an emergency. I'm not at home. I've lost my wallet. You know, I want to do something. Mm-hmm. And now it's, mobile banking. They completely cut that out. They use whatever authentication your phone has. So two-factor is at this point where everyone always has their mobile.
Yep.
And a good part of it, if, for example, you know, like right now, we're on this call, we're recording this podcast. If you get a notification that someone's trying to log into Facebook, you know, because of two-factor authentication that, someone's actually trying to log into my Facebook.
Mm.
It's a good warning system to know that something is happening.
Yeah.
And when we look at Gmail, the day you sign into a new device on Gmail, they send you notifications on everything. They let you know that, was that you? They're asking.
Yeah, sure that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I have seen that. It's very clever. I mean, we're not naive on it. You know, it's two-factor authentication can be hacked, just like everything else. I remember the token thing you were talking about with the bank. You know, I used to have one of those. For the life of me, could not remember where I put it, and I never logged into banking for a good year or something like that. You know, it was a horrible time. But it's gotten to the point where it is super convenient because, like you say, we all have our mobile phones on us. It's not that much difficult, not that difficult to get the code from there and so on and so forth. One thing that I've been experimenting with is something called YubiKey. I don't know if are you familiar with it, but it's basically a USB key, which is apparently the strongest form of two-factor authentication that there is. Not just that brand. I mean, there are other ones out there, but this is the one that I've got, and it's in effect, you can't hack it because you need the physical key. And once you insert it and push the button on it, it'll generate a one-time code, which, you know, two-factor authentication will do. But most hackers tend not to be, you know, in the same room as you. They tend to be miles away. So if you need the actual key to do it, I think it's never been hacked before. Because you need the key. Very clever.
Wow.
But it's...
That's a bold claim. Because it's rare you ever hear something that's never been hacked before.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As far as I'm led to believe. As far as I'm led to believe, it's never been hacked. I will check that just after we come off this.
I'll definitely look into it. Because I know when I was looking into mobile phones,
mm-hmm.
in America, there was a big problem with phone number cloning.
Okay.
And it all kicked off from the fact that if someone finds your phone number online, or that you even connect with them, it's possible in the UK. So in a scenario that, you know, you shared your phone number and someone finds out your full name,
mm-hmm.
if you have a limited liability company, that means you're registered on a company's house.
Yep.
Unfortunately, for some businesses, has your home address. If someone was to call your mobile network, and have the right information. So when they ask the secret question, you know, what school did you go to? And all they do is go on your Facebook and they see, you went to that room. By marrying all that information up, they can actually request to change your number.
Wow.
And in that weird period where it still hasn't swapped, texts can actually go to the new number that they've chosen.
Right.
And yeah, it was one of those, when I read it, I was like, wow.
What a terrifying world we live in.
And this is all the one source of, I guess, the cyber tool being used is just Google.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's the kind of the hub. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, we've certainly dived into what the problems look like. You know, I mean, is there any good news in the cyber world? You know, is there anything that we can actually do to sort of protect ourselves a little bit more? Like you'd mentioned there, I mean, some information is just unfortunately out there and people will use that to their advantage. But we've went through the privacy settings on social media. We've looked at phishing. I mean, the only defense you've really got other with your two-factor authentication is your password. The amount of people I've seen that use the same password for pretty much everything is quite scary. But more than that, they write it on a post-it and then put it under the keyboard. I've seen that quite a lot as well.
I saw that, I think it was a few years ago. So in, I forget the country, I think it was Hawaii.
Okay.
Where they were showing off their, you know, emergency response system.
Okay.
So this is what lets the islanders know that, oh, there could be a tsunami or anything happening. And as they took pictures of the responders' desks, there on a yellow post-it note was the admin password.
Oh, no.
And yeah. And I think in terms of how, I guess, people can stop using the post-it note, password management tools.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've got one of them. I have done for, I think it's about 3 years. I've been using LastPass. Not for any preference over the other password managers, really, but it's just the first one that I clicked on, to be honest. And I've never went back.
I used to use LastPass, and then I made the change recently to 1Password.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Was there any reason for that?
I liked the integration into Chrome more.
Oh, it's okay. That's interesting. Yeah. For those that are listening, I mean, LastPass has recently announced a change in their service, which I don't think is going to please a lot of people. And they had mentioned that you can only use the free version on one device.
Oh, wow.
Which is a little limiting, you know?
It's, that's because if you think of even in front of me right now, I have a mobile phone, an iPad, and a laptop.
Absolutely. Now, to clarify, it will work on your tablet, an iPad, and your mobile. But that's because it's a mobile version, if you like. Whereas if you install it on a desktop, it won't work on the mobile version. It's a very limiting thing, and not something that pleased me. So it was interesting to know which one you chose, actually, because I might have a look into that now.
Yeah, there's an open source one, KeePass. So that's free and open sourced. So that's another alternative for people to use. It isn't as, I guess, cloud and internet friendly as LastPass. That's the only gripe. So it's more of a desktop application. But I think it's definitely the way to go. So even as I've been helping startups, I understand, like, you know, password security. By being able to generate passwords in these tools, it means that a lot of team members don't ever know a password, but they have the tools to log into anything that they require for their job. And yeah, it just adds that extra layer of security.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the technical side of it, really, but it uses, what is it, AES-256 bit encryption, which we could try and explain all day if we wanted to, but basically it's a heavily encrypted system, but all you need is the 1Password. And if I'm correct, you may want to correct me if I'm wrong on this one, really, is once you enter your master password, it only decrypts the information on the device that you're using.
Yeah. And I think one aspect of this, I think that a lot of people will find interesting, is when you copy passwords, depending on the tool, sometimes you actually can't copy them. You just have to click and it automatically logs you in. And that's an interesting function. So if you think of even a small business or someone with a small business and they share credentials, because they might need to use one account.
Yeah.
This helps. And it's just that extra peace of mind. So I always try and tell people that it's not as complex as, you know, people sell it. It's actually such an easy thing that integrates so well with everything you're already doing. Except this is now just a safe where you can keep more than just passwords. So if you wanted a safe place to store documents, good place to go. And
Yeah, I mean, I use it for even things like bank details. You know, your card information. I've used it for that. Some files and things like that. It is a very, very useful tool. There is the argument that people have, you know, you're putting all your eggs in one basket. But, you know, if I get a hold of your master password, then, you know, I can have access to your entire life. I suppose that is true, I guess, to a certain degree. If we add in two-factor authentication to it and so on, it becomes a little trickier for them. But it's...
Yeah. And even these audits, audit tracking. So even when I use 1Password and I add someone else to it, so it could be my cousin, I added her to the account, I get a notification that says, yeah, this person has done this. So even when they view passwords, I can actually see what passwords they've looked at. So you also get that added security measure of, okay, you understand. And it even tells me when I try and log in that, oh, is that you trying to log in from Liverpool? And if it's not me, then yeah, I'm just like, ooh, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean it's a very, very interesting tool. I would highly encourage everyone to start using one. They've got things like a security check, so it can tell you which passwords are being reused, which ones may have been compromised. Definitely. We'll put some links into to a couple of them to kind of get things going. A very, very interesting outlook that you seem to have on cybersecurity as a whole. It's certainly the mind of someone that works in the field is always fascinating to me. You look at something pretty innocently, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the image of the rhino. You look at something like that and you think, well, we can find out where that rhino is, and you know, poachers can use that for this purpose. And it's very dark and almost makes you paranoid. But yeah, incredibly relevant.
It's a strange, I guess that's one of the misfortunes of cyber, because sometimes when I do look at something, I have to put the security hat on first.
Yeah.
And say, oh, that sounds good. But it's not all doom and gloom. There is fun elements to cybersecurity.
Of course there are. Of course there are. And it's not as complicated as people make it out to be. You know, that's one of the things we certainly try to get across. There are little bits and pieces that you can do yourself. For example, install a password manager, have a look at those, get the two-factor authentication going. And above all else is simply just pay attention to what you're looking at. It could be a phishing email, for one.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we're now at a point where there's so many different resources as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if, you know, the cybersecurity hat has been thrust upon you and you're not comfortable, there's different avenues to skill up. YouTube is always, you know, a good start-off point. Most, there's always someone who's reviewed something.
There has, there is now, yeah.
Of someone blending an iPhone, you can find a review for any tool.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Yeah, the amount of videos on YouTube is unbelievable. It's been incredibly interesting to talk to you, Steve. I want to thank you for that. Thanks for your time. Absolute pleasure. I hope people that listen got some value out of this as well. I certainly have. If nothing else, I'm going to go and see about maybe changing over my password manager. So,
thank you very much for the invite. Yeah, it's been really great conversation.
Well, thanks again. Perhaps we can do it in a couple of months as well. You know, when you've got some more free time, and we can update the conversation as it goes. Cybersecurity is an ever-evolving thing, so there was probably going to be some changes.
Most definitely.
Well, brilliant. Thanks again, Stephen, and thank you all for listening. I hope you really enjoyed it, and we can see you next time.
Yeah. Thank you.
That is all we have for this week. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a like and subscribe to hear more from experts around the globe. And head over to opensourceguardian.com for more great content, all targeting the world of cybersecurity. Until next time, remember, it shouldn't be complicated, so we don't make it so.